accession number 27310, Reel 3.
City Gabba, Reel 3. Did the American aircraft differ from the British aircraft that you've flown before?
To a very great extent. I mean, these were powerful warplanes. Three of them were fighter planes, Wildcats, Hellcats, Corsairs, and the Avenger was a torpedo bomber. They were real aircraft, and we familiarised on that. I forget how long it took, certainly two, 3 weeks, something like that. And from there I went on to going up to Streatham, where there was a maintenance unit, and I joined a small flight of two Fleetowran pilots and six RAF pilots. The RAF pilots, two or three of them were ex-operational. The other Fleet Air Arm pilot and myself were trainees, where we joined together. We both met at Worthy Down, and we went to Streatham together, and we're still friends to this day.
With these American aircraft, though, they must have much more powerful to fly than the
very much more so.
The speed. Is there anything that you have to be aware of when flying such a powerful aircraft, say the Corsair or the Hellcat?
Well, yes, that they're big beasts, that there is no doubt. The Corsair was a very powerful aircraft which had to be handled very carefully. It had all sorts of characteristics, you had to watch them.
Because one of the characteristics I've heard about is that it had very poor visibility.
Not that I would remember. You had, for instance, of course, you had a long nose in front of you, so that you took off not actually seeing where you were going until you got your tail up. But I'd flown subsequent to that, I'd flown another aircraft which was even worse, which was the Firebrand, Fairey Firebrand, which had an even longer nose, and that was very difficult. But no, as far as I'm concerned, the American aircraft, the Corsair, had a tendency to bite you if you did it wrong, but the Wildcat was also a peculiar aircraft in that it was a very bouncy undercarriage, and if you landed that in a crosswind, you was in danger of getting it wrong.
With a bouncy undercarriage, and you say with the danger of getting it wrong, what could happen with that bouncy undercarriage?
Well, if you hit the deck too hard, you bounce up again, and with the danger of damaging the undercarriage. And you'd learn how to control it once you thought you'd landed and taken off again. So bear in mind, you've cut the throttle to land, and therefore you have to pick it up again by catching it at the top, landing it again.
And with American aircraft, is there a different sort of cockpit layout, or is there anything that's different from the way the British aircraft were constructed?
I don't believe so, no. I don't believe so.
Are they more roomy?
No, they were always every inch of space was taken up, and they didn't. The worst one on roominess was a Spitfire. I was a 12-stone gentleman at that time, and in a Spitfire, my shoulders touched both sides. But they weren't more roomy. They took up all the space they could do.
And Streatham, what were you doing? What was your role there?
There was a maintenance unit there where they would carry out long, extensive services of aircraft, and we would then take them, ferry them to their destination. We flew from there to Ireland very often. We flew from there to Scotland, where we'd deliver the aircraft which had their big heavy maintenance check. We'd take them over to where we were.
Would you air test them?
No, we weren't expected to air test them. Yes. No, I don't believe that. we go up before you. No, it would be wrong to say we air tested them. We ferried them.
Would you have an opportunity though to fly those aircraft in, you know, rather than just the ferrying side of things? Would you have would you be able to fly them on a daily basis or?
No, I don't think so. I think we knew how the aircraft flew, and eventually we became adept of flying from one aircraft to another. But I think to say if you wanted to go operational, you'd have to have a fairly intensive course. It may not be a long course, but you would have to need to know what was going on.
When you flew it to these destinations, I take it you would fly it to the operational.
Yes.
How would you get back?
We also had at this place we had an Anson, and we also had a little plane. Oh, we had two little planes. We had a Stinson Reliant and a Beechcraft Traveller, so that for instance, if two of our planes were going across to Northern Ireland, another one would go with the Beechcraft to pick us up and bring us back. We had the Anson, which if we needed more than, if we had four or five people going.
It sounds like a real opportunity to fly a large variety of aircraft.
Well, that's why I've got so many in my, I think I've probably got about 20 in my logbook.
Did you enjoy the variety?
Well, that's right. If we ever got an aircraft come in that wasn't a regular thing, I'd always take the opportunity to take it up and fly it. And I remember we had a Firefly there that I flew, the Firebrand, which was a very new aircraft. There were various other aircraft that I flew that were opportunistic. I think the Fulmar, I flew the Fulmar there. I also, while I was at Worthy-Down, flew Barracudas. I'd take those on a delivery flight.
What was the Barracuda like?
Not very good. It was. It had a lot of faults, which they found out when they were flying them operationally. I never had an occasion to have any problem with them. I merely took them from A to B. If there was an aircraft at Worthy-Down that had to go up to North, I'd always seek to get on it and fly it there.
Am I right in thinking it was an unusual looking aircraft?
It was a most unusual aircraft, and it had a lot of failures. It was certainly the they'd go into a spin for some reason or other that they never could explain.
Did you have no problems at all?
I never had any problems with the Barracuda, no.
While you were doing a lot of your ferrying work, were there any occasions when you did have a problem with an aircraft at all?
I did one. My second crash occurred because I flew a Wildcat 5 just from Warrington to Wolverhampton to Cosford, and as I was doing the circuit to land, the propeller stopped and I had to force land it in the field. And the reason for the failure was that I was flying on reserve tank, because previously I'd flown Wildcat 6s in which the stopcock on the petrol tank, the first stop was main. On the 5, the first stop was reserve. So I ran out of fuel and force landed in the field.
So with that, with the stopcock, with the Wildcat 5 operation, would that mean that it would use its reserve tank first?
No. You, a pilot who knew what he was doing, would put it onto main. The reserve tank only came in when you ran out of main.
Was that a difficulty sometimes, though? Obviously, you're familiarising yourself with a new aircraft.
That was always a difficulty. You had to look at the handling notes. If you took a new aircraft up, you should take look at the handling notes to decide what was which. It was my fault that I took I'd only flown Wildcat 6s, and this was a 5, and I didn't take notice of that essential point.
And obviously you forced landing. Could you tell me how you'd go about making a forced landing?
Praying. The engine cut out when I was at about 1,000 feet on the downwind leg. Now, you normally want to land upwind, but there was no hope for me going to 180 degrees in order to land. So I took off to port, where I saw a field, and I headed for that field. I did everything wrong. One of the things about a forced landing is you put the wheels up, because you cause less damage by skating along on your belly than you would sort of going nose down or whatever. Because I had to wind the wheels up and down on this Wildcat, I didn't wind the wheels up when I was sent round. So I was there flying downwind with the wheels down. I headed for this field. Just as I got near there, I saw some telegraph wires, and I put my flaps down and went over them, and I landed in the field belting across. At that stage, I should have let the undercarriage down and stopped, but I didn't, and I headed between two trees, which took the wing off, and I walked out.
We weren't injured in that?
Not injured at all, no.
I imagine it's quite difficult to make decisions in such a short space of time when you're having to do a forced landing.
You do think quickly, yes.
How did you feel about walking away from that? Was that?
It's peculiar. Whether time has dimmed my memories, I wasn't in any way particularly scared or frightened. I'd walked away from it. And I went. They sent another aircraft down to pick me up, and I came back. And in those days, they insisted that you went into the sanatorium for 24 hours. I went in, and they gave me a sleeping pill, and I slept. And 2 days later, I was flying. I really didn't have any great sense that I'd have walked away with death. I didn't.
Because I was saying, obviously you'd had two crashes. Did you feel the need then to get straight back to flying afterwards?
Didn't feel any need. I just flew. That was it. I was only, 20-odd. One didn't have any great... I was scared when I was flying very often. You get over the sea and you think the engine's saying a bit wonky and you start to panic.
I was going to say that actually with the sea. Do pilots feel uncomfortable over the sea?
We used to say that the engine got rougher as soon as you left Liverpool. The engine got rougher, but I don't know. I didn't feel. I only did it across to Ireland, and it wouldn't be any great shakes.
So how long were you doing that ferrying work then?
I went there. I would have got there round about the end of... No. I was at Worthy Down in 40... In the time of D-Day. So that would have been April, I suppose. April, May, June, 44. And I was there until I left in March, 46.
Over that time, how many hours did you amass of flying...
I flew about 1,000 hours, all told, just under 1,000 hours.
And how did you come to be demobilised?
Well, demobilised was fairly easy. They gave me a suit and I went home. That was it. And I went back into the tailoring business. And then I left 3 years later and went somewhere else.
Did you enjoy your service in the town?
Loved it. Loved it. It's hard to say, but I was a little sorry when the war ended. I was having the time of my life. I was a two-ringer, a pilot, and enjoying my life.
How were Fleet Air Arm pilots seen by the public and society?
I wouldn't know. There was certain glamour to it, of course, but no, I wouldn't have said it was... Certainly doesn't mean anything now, but... In those days, we were something, yeah.
Did you consider staying on?
Yeah, they offered... We had a four-year short service commission and a 12-year short offered to us. But my father died just as I was joining the Fleet Air Arm, and my mother was on her own with my two brothers. so therefore it wasn't a real prospect. The funny thing was that 2 years later, in 1947, I was offered a very lucrative job flying aircraft to Israel, which I also turned down. But I love flying, but I could never afford to fly again, and I had home responsibilities.
Thank you very much.